Welcome to Teneo Insights, a podcast that provides in-depth analysis on the issues that matter most to CEOs and their businesses. I'm your host, Kevin Kajiwara, co-president of Teneo's political risk advisory business. Let's get started.
Today, we're going to continue our ongoing series of discussions on diversity, equity, and inclusion. And today, we're going to focus in particular on Black participation at the leadership level, where we are and how to get where we need to get. Because when you disaggregate the data, improved diversity has not actually been equally distributed among all underrepresented minority groups. And we're also going to be looking at the commitment necessary from the highest corporate levels, meaning the C-suite, meaning the board, but most particularly meaning the CEO. Because ultimately, this really is not about checking boxes or compliance. It's really about business strategy at the end of the day. I'm joined today by three guests who have devoted their professional lives to effecting this necessary change, beyond pledges, beyond narrative, but by equipping leaders with the data and the tools necessary to meet these objectives. So Valerie Rainford, she is the founder and CEO of Ellery Talent Services, which is a leadership advisory firm for C-suite executives on advancing Black talent. Valerie led JP Morgan Chase's Advancing Black Leaders strategy. She was the first Black female senior vice president at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. She is the vice chair of the Executive Leadership Council, and she is a trustee of Fordham University. Jamal Simmons, well known to many of you as a political contributor on CBS and NPR and others. He produced and hosted Hill TV digital programming, and he is he's a Washington veteran on the on strategic communications and public affairs front. He's a veteran of various political campaigns, and he's gotten a lot of attention of late for his article in the journal earlier this year, in the journal Democracy, called The 4% Problem, which detailed the consistently low rate of Black representation at leadership across institutional types, from corporations to government to the military to academic institutions, et cetera. And he offers a fresh approach to, you know, to fixing the so-called pipeline problem. And we're also joined today by my colleague, Lisa Davis. She's a senior MD here at Teneo, based in Washington, D.C., and she's the co-chair of Teneo's Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Advisory Group. She's an experienced strategy and communications professional. She was corporate vice president for communications at Northrop Grumman and has held numerous other positions in the public and private sector. So thanks very much, all of you, for joining me today. And I want to start by setting the table here a little bit. We all know that we, meaning, you know, society and as well as individual companies, that we need to do better. We all know that. And if we didn't, we wouldn't be having this this call today. And those of us who are interested in this issue, and especially those who are working through this issue every single day to rectify the situation, are well aware of at least the headline data. But sometimes I think data can be presented in new and illuminating ways. So Jamal, I want to start with you, if I can. Because what was really compelling and what was really frustrating about your piece is that even well-intentioned leaders and organizations can run into some significant hurdles. So can you lay out for us, you know, your findings and what that 4% number is, why it's so consistent?
Thank you, Kevin. Thanks for having me. Thanks, Neo and Lisa and Valerie. It's an honor to be on here with you. And thank you all for joining. So what happened was, last year happened, which we all lived through, right? And we were home and, you know, we saw the tragedy that happened because of what happened in Minneapolis. And in the midst of the kind of the wrenching upheaval that took place, where people started coming to the streets and people were protesting, and we saw months of people really being active, we saw corporations really try to step up. I took a lot of phone calls. I sat on a lot of these calls virtually where people said, well, what can I do? What can we do? And one of the things that occurred to me as I began to talk through it, first of all, you can do the things that you do for a living. You should do those things with a lens of equity involved and thinking about how they impact the communities that are being left behind. That was my primary advice. But also then take stock of what's happening inside the company. Why is it that perhaps your company hasn't been thinking about these questions? And so as I started to wrestle with this, and having spent a career advising leaders, I mean, my first job in politics, I traveled on a plane with Bill Clinton every day when he was running for president. You know, I worked for Al Gore when he was running for president. I worked for cabinet secretaries when I was the Clinton administration, traveling around the world in international trade negotiations. I saw a lot of what was happening. And then as a corporate, as a consultant, I talked to people in nonprofits and in C-suites. And one of the things that became clear to me is that when companies and people and political leaders have a problem, the first thing they do is they call the smart people they know who work for them into a room, onto a call, into a Zoom, and they say, okay, things have hit the fan. What do we do now? Right? And one of the most telling pictures I remember from 9/11, from after 9/11, which I'm sure you all probably remember too, in the immediate aftermath of the attack on the World Trade Center, the White House convened a group together to try to figure out what to do. President Bush was flying back from an event where he was. So Dick Cheney, the vice president, was in the room. And who else was in that room? Condi Rice was in that room because she was the national security advisor. Karen Hughes was in that room because she was the president's counselor. Alberto Gonzalez was in that room because he was White House counsel. Ultimately, Colin Powell was in that room because he was the Secretary of State, along with Don Rumsfeld and all the others. Right. So they got together the people who mattered. And what happened was, and I'll give him credit for this, George W. Bush had a team around him that was diverse ethnically and racially. And that group of people is who was there. Because you know what? At a moment of crisis, you don't have time to think about who's our person who, you know, we might think about who's not here or look around the room and try to figure out what to do. You call the people that you need. And so you got to have people that you need who are reflective all the time. So with that backdrop, I began sort of going through data, and I realized part of the problem that was occurring was because of people like me, people who spin for a living. So I call it spinning the elephant, right? So if you think about this, the parable of the blind man, you look at an elephant, what you touch is what you think you see. So as a spinner, as a communications professional, what we often do is, you know, my job is to say, hey, look, there's an elephant in front of us. Look at the trunk and the big flapping ears. Don't pay attention to the stinking mass in the back, right? We want you to look at the things up front that you think are important. And so that's what happened with diversity data. All the organizations that were facing this question, and the question came to me is, who are the people around leaders when they have to make these tough calls? All the people who were, all the organizations that were tackling this question, I began to see this pattern when you got past the underrepresented minority question, when you got the data, when you got past the overall institutional data. So, you know, a company like Amazon, because it's, you know, 26% or so, you know, diverse, but that includes people who work in the warehouse, not just the people who work in the C-suite or the S team, as they call it at Amazon. So when you get past all that, you look at the people who are around the leaders. I started to see this 4% question. Let me just give you two examples and I'll stop talking and let everybody else get in. The first is, Damian Williams, who is just been appointed to be the U.S. attorney in Manhattan, in Southern District of New York. Damian Williams is a phenomenal leader, it appears. And so but if you look at the course of his trajectory, let's take a look. He went to Harvard University. At Harvard, there were 3.5% of tenured faculty at Harvard are Black. He went to Yale. 3.7% of tenured faculty at Yale are Black. He worked at Paul Weiss as a lawyer at Paul Weiss. 6 out of 144 partners are Black. That's 4.2%. He was a Supreme Court clerk, and someone did an analysis that looked at Supreme Court clerks over a bunch of years. 20 out of 487 Supreme Court clerks were Black. That's 4.1%, right? So these numbers started sort of popping up. So I say this to say, we're looking for Damian Williamses, and we want to find them, but the institutions that we're going to looking for them may not be the places where all the future talent is going to be. The last example I'll give you is Colin Powell. Colin Powell just passed away. We think of Colin Powell as a great leader. Colin Powell hasn't been, he was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, which is how most of us came to know who he was. When we think of Colin Powell then, that was over 25 years ago that he had that job. There hasn't been another African-American or person of color who has chaired the Joint Chiefs of Staff since. Today, the military is 43% people of color, 17% African-American. There are only 2 out of the 41 most senior commanders in the military across all 4 branches who could be qualified or could be in line to be chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. That number just keeps showing up, that 4 point something, 3.5, 3.7. If this were a parking lot with 100 spaces in it, it's not that 4% is a ceiling, because there are some places that do better than that. But it's that all the black cars would seem to be clustered around space number 4. And so what is it that's driving that? And I think we should talk more about prototypicality, the search for black unicorns, and this threshold idea that, you know, how many people should we really have around here? There are all kinds of questions that we have to ask about how we end up with this 4% that becomes a very consistent number across military, law, Fortune 500, C-suites, board positions. You know, you can kind of go down publishing. You can kind of go down the line of the big institutions in America, and they keep showing up with the same number.
Yeah, one of the things that I found interesting in your piece was that even on that continuum of progressive to reactionary, it actually didn't really matter in a way. You brought up the Supreme Court clerking. Ruth Bader Ginsburg, in her years on the Supreme Court, had one black clerk in that entire time. So, Valerie, I know you are particularly data driven in your approach to working with companies and with CEOs. And one of the uncomfortable truths, I sort of brought this up at the beginning, one of the uncomfortable truths you consistently uncover is that even as companies improve on the diversity front in leadership, black inclusion still lags that of other underrepresented minorities. That would seem to square certainly with what Jamal was just talking about. But describe to us your findings on that front and how that then is resonating within the C-suite.
Yeah, so thank you and thanks for having me. And the reality, I think, is with some intentionality, we get to 4%. But the majority of organizations are not even there when you just look at their senior leadership level. And I think to Jamal's point, when you look at many organizations are looking at their data, they're looking at the data in aggregated fashion with all underrepresented minorities together. And I believe that inequity is actually hiding in aggregated data. Because no matter how I'm privileged to work with CEOs to look underneath the data to find out what's happening, particularly for each cohort. And right after George Floyd, we were working with organizations specifically around Black, but we do it for all cohorts. And no matter what size company, what industry, when you disaggregate the data, Black talent is consistently left behind at every level. And by the way, many organizations are still struggling to get to that 4% at the most senior level. And Latinx talent is typically right behind them. And there are huge gaps between those two populations of people and any other diverse segment in the organization that's measured.
So Lisa, when you engage with companies, you know, on the DE&I front more broadly, you know, how do they acknowledge these data discrepancies that Valerie is talking about? Or is that, I mean, you know, she sort of talks about how you can hide the problem in the aggregated data. Do they want to stay there, or what are you finding?
That intentionality is often voiced, and in a lot of cases, it's there. Where people struggle and where we continue to work is what to do about it. And the first step is, as Jamal pointed out, let's look at what the situation really is. The next step is exactly what Valerie has taken almost to a high art with her, you know, analytics, and certainly with her work, you know, in prior organizations, actually bringing out results. So it's like, okay, we understand this. Now let's focus on the results. And that's where we intend and where we do a lot of work. But that intentionality has to be very strong within that C-suite and with the CEO. And we can talk a little about the CEO's role in this, because the number one thing that we see is after the pronouncements come out, you know, after, you know, the announcements are made and, you know, maybe there's a program, it really is going to require the rest of the organization, and particularly middle management, to make sure that these things happen. And middle management is looking at the top. for role modeling. Now, there's a whole process around which to get middle managers engaged. And we do that, we've seen that, but it does start at the CEO level, the CEO suite, and being able to take the kind of stand and not just talk, but also be able to lead the organization in a way that empowers every group that's needed to make sure that we get past 4%, or as Valerie pointed out, get up to 4%.
I was going to make two other points on data that I think are really important. And that is, if senior leaders had a problem in any other aspect of their business, the first thing they would want to do is understand that problem for their specific organization. Where are we good? How do we get more margin? What will it take? We tend not to do that around this subject. So looking at the diversity challenge, not just everybody's out doing a proclamation on getting, 50% growth, so I must too, but what exactly is the problem inside your organization? And the only way you're going to get there is through data. The other thing I would say is often when I say you have to unleash the data to identify where the problem opportunities are, the first thing people hear is, wait, so I got to give my data out publicly? I suggest that you start looking at it internally inside your organization so that you can plan and set a strategy that you can communicate externally. But if you never do that, you almost leap to everybody's looking for my external data. And the key here is it's the entire life cycle of data. Most CEOs are just getting representation data. But what's happening inside your recruiting functions? One of the statistics that I give almost every organization that says we can't find Black talent, the Black talent is applying, but not getting through the recruiting process. We don't have strong Black talent. Well, Black talent consistently being rated lower performers, not being promoted at the same rate. So when I talk about data and disaggregating data, like what's the experience of the talent inside your own firm? The only way you'll solve that is if you know that data in a disaggregated way across the life cycle. Does that make sense?
No, that absolutely makes sense. But I want to, I appreciate the way you guys have all set this up. But if there's a consistent message that's come across, regardless of who has to execute, regardless of the how embraced the actual data is, the thing that keeps coming out is the leadership element here. So
absolutely.
I want to focus for a moment here on some of the successes that we're seeing out there, and because that really demonstrates what works. And you're all touching on it. But Valerie, as I mentioned at the top, your success at JP Morgan Chase on this front, is something to celebrate. But in our conversations, you've continued to say that no matter what policies are put in place, no matter what positions are effectively created to deal with this, the key element is CEO commitment and conviction. So talk about that a little bit. I mean, it sounds like this is still sort of a rare thing, actually. And yeah. How do you, because I know you sort of need that. If you're going to work with an organization, you need to see that commitment and conviction from the CEO.
Yeah. Not only do I need it, but I look for it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. How do you recognize that that's actually there and not just lip service, essentially?
Well, the first question is typically, will they let me have access to all of their data? Right. If the answer to that question is yes, I know the conversation is worth continuing. I could in private talk about who are some of the CEOs I've done it with. And usually that's enough to see whether the conversation is worth continuing. But there's something the good news is I've seen both the good and the not good scenarios here, which is how I have derived what I think good looks like. And the leaders that I see realizing change all have something in common. They're willing to learn, try something new, be uncomfortable in the space, push their teams, understand and own the business challenge, not just that it's the right thing to do, but they're missing opportunity by not having this talent at the table. And they're willing to be vocal about it at least inside their own organizations, right? So some leaders are pushing the needle inside their organizations. That's good enough. You don't all need to be the leader who, you know, in fact, I prefer you not be the leader who stands on TV and say, here's what we're going to do. I care more about what you're doing with your people inside the organization. So that's what I call conviction, right? Conviction to unleash the data to understand what problems you specifically, Mr. C-suite leader, are sitting on top of. And by the way, when leaders of your team tell you that there's risk in doing so, to say, I'm willing to take that risk to understand what we need to do. That to me is when I say conviction, what I mean.
But something has to happen before you get to conviction. I mean, I guess the question is there something innate here, or does something happen? I mean, how do you help them get there?
I think that there is something innate that the leaders that I think are making progress have, and that is fairness and equity. They want to see fairness and equity. Sometimes they don't realize that inequity exists. So being willing to open up the data to see the inequity for themselves and being committed to doing something about it. Like, there's no senior leader that I've shown the rejection rate in the recruiting process. Here's where your recruiting process is broken, where 75% of qualified Black talent are being rejected early in the cycle before they even get to your hiring managers. Immediately, particularly when you're spending millions of dollars on recruiting and it's not generating you the results, the wise C-suite leader is going to say, wait, that's not good return on investment, right? So that leader who's willing to understand that these issues that we talk about broadly in community are happening inside your own organization, and you have to pay attention in order to resolve them, to get past 2%, 3%, much less 4%, Jamal, right?
And interestingly, with Jamal, I was going to just ask if there's this, we talk about this sort of 4% threshold, and I'm trying to uncover whether there is something special about that number, because one of the intriguing things you point out in there is that there's almost this unwillingness to stand a little bit further forward. If everybody's at 4%, then everybody's, you can look around and, you've done as well as everybody else has, essentially. But if you're the company that's got 10% representation, then the spotlight goes on you and you have to explain yourself in some way, shape, or form. I mean, is there a peer issue here that that is impacting this as well?
Yes. When you talk to the researchers, I mean, because this isn't what I do for a living. What I do for a living is I counsel people on how to manage crisis, how to make big strategic decisions. What occurs to me is the people in those rooms tend to very often be very similar to the CEO or the person who's the leader. So asking questions about, are you really getting a full understanding of the problems that exist, because you've got people who see those problems from different perspectives. Some of those are racial and gender perspectives. Some of them are just like our class perspectives. There are all kinds of ways to address it, but the Black perspective is worthwhile. There are some researchers who looked at this threshold question, and they came up with a kind of an interesting term they call toucanism. But they were looking at women on boards in particular. So for a long time, there tended to be one woman on a board. At one point, people began to say, hey, wait a minute, one woman isn't enough. We need more women on boards. So what the people did was they looked around and they said, well, how many women are over there? And how many are over here? And, people sort of peer modeled and figured out what was happening. And then they figured out if they got two women on a board, that kind of quieted the horses. People stopped asking as many questions. So it went from one person being on the board, which they called tokenism, to two people being on the board, which they called toucanism, right? And so, and it was amazingly consistent across the spectrum. That starts because they went just, and the interesting part about it is they went just beyond the point of negative scrutiny and then stopped trying. Oh. It raises the question of the commitment has to be not just to get to the tape, but to go through the tape and to keep sort of pushing it and making it a part of the organizational ethos that we want to have diverse people around. And they also saw this begin to happen, you know, obviously with people of color. And so lastly, so we know the power of three, right? So what you need to go is get from tokenism. You need to have three people in a room that are probably different to really get some as much bang out of that buck as you possibly can.
Threekinism,
exactly. I'm sorry, Kevin. That was their point. That at some point there will be threekinism because people will realize two is not enough. And so then everybody will go to three and you'll see three become a standard across the model.
I'm curious about Black leaders themselves. You know, once they ascend into these positions of leadership, you know, is it axiomatic that they do better on this front and have that commitment, or are sometimes the institutional barriers so entrenched in the organizations that they're leaders in that they are actually back at the same square one that every other leader is, and particularly knowing that for better or for worse, for those who are their critics, to those who are their supporters, is going to, you know, every action is going to be refracted through a slightly different lens. So what do you find in terms of Black leaders themselves on this front?
So this is the place where Valerie's point about disaggregating the data is so incredibly important, because what tends to happen is organizations have cultures, and there's often great resistance to changing the culture. And so the people who are the leadership in the organization see themselves and their path to leadership as the prototypical path in order to become a leader in this organization. So they start looking for other people who will fit this model. I come from the political world as a background. This happened a lot in political communications, right? People sort of look around and they say, oh, well, I was a press secretary for a senator, and then I was a communications director for a governor, and then I went to the White House and I was a deputy press secretary of the White House. You know, so they say, I want people who have had that path. Well, if that's the standard that you're going to use, you're going to miss a lot of the African-American talent that might be there, because the challenges to recruitment start so early that you don't see people get those check marks on their resume that might be the prototypical check marks. So, one point I look at is in tech, which is another piece of my work previously, is, you know, most of the tech industry recruits out of five schools. You know them, Stanford, USC, University of Washington. There are like five schools that people recruit from primarily. Of those five schools, in 2019, there were 24 African Americans who got computer science degrees. Not 24 each, right? Like 24 combined, right? A school like Georgia Tech has like 27 African Americans who got degrees alone. University of Maryland, Baltimore County, where Friedman Hrabowski is doing a phenomenal job focusing on people of color, and getting them through, you know, it has like 80 people, of, you know, 80 African-Americans who got degrees that year. So if you're only going to recruit from the same number of schools, then you're not really going to have a pool that is going to be that great. And so what you got to do, I think, is fish in the tanks that are stocked, and maybe make sure that those fish are getting fed what they need in order to be of the quality and type that you need. So in broadly speaking, what we see is Black leaders tend to produce more Black leaders. And it's very hard in mainstream organizations to see Black leadership emerge without there being Black leadership already present. So you see this chicken and an egg. Well, what I would say, if this is the point where, like, if you're thinking about the pipeline, to start at the entry point of the pipeline is a Dodge. You got to start at the top of the leadership. And then I would say build scaffolding with leaders in the elbow joints of that scaffolding that are going to help people navigate your organization, so that you end up having a broader group of people who are coming in and a wider group of people who are making it through all the levels and not getting dinged in ways that Valerie talked about earlier, where they're being judged by not their potential to do great things, but hard projects that they've been given that they've had to prove themselves able to accomplish. Here's one last thing I'll leave you with. I spent a lot of time in the tech world. I sat down when I was trying to fund the company I was building. I sat down with an African-American venture capitalist, and I asked him about, we were too early for him to invest in, but we started talking about the path and how to get forward. And so what he said to me was that he had never seen, this was a few years ago, it maybe is different now. He had never seen a Black-led company get funded based on an idea. Now, we actually had a product we were building, so he wanted us to wait till our product was built. He said Black companies get funded when they have a product, then they get funded when they have revenue. They don't get funded because somebody has, oh, that's a great idea, let's invest in that and see what you can do. Or that's just a great product. The question then becomes, was anybody willing to pay for that product? So what we found, I had a CFO who had been a CFO consultant who had been in other companies, and we kept focusing on how to, our revenue model. And he would say, well, yeah, let's spend a little bit of time on that, but let's not get too hung up on that. Let's just go out and try to sell the product. The problem is what the funding people will tell you is Black people don't get funded without showing that they can raise revenue. The idea of just being able to go out and say, we got a great product, we'll figure out how to make money off of it, just doesn't exist for African-American companies. It's got to be a little more concrete. I think that same propensity exists inside broader corporate America, where African-Americans are judged on results, not judged on possibility.
Right. And I guess we're about to get our biggest, the next big high profile example here is evident here in New York City. The Eric Adams administration is going to be announced over there. And it's always interesting in government, right, is that they actually get to clear the decks and assign all new positions. So it'll be very interesting to watch as he unveils his administration over the next couple of weeks heading toward January 1st. So Lisa, all right, so here we are. Let's assume for a moment that we have this committed leadership. Let's assume that the data is fully presented to them and they have absorbed it. So now the daunting question is, how do we get started? What do we do now? Now that we're here, we have to get some, we want to get some early wins. We want to get some, you know, the medium-term prospects. And then I need to institutionalize this, because at the end of the day, I'm not going to deliver on all of these objectives while I am still CEO. It's going to be one or two CEOs down the road. It's an ever-changing, it's an ever-evolving process. How do we institutionalize this now within the organization so it's not just dependent on my conviction as a leader? How do you translate what we've been talking about up until now to actual action items that they can point to as successes?
Yeah, and that's a good question. I'm actually going to answer that directly. But first, I want to raise 2 points. And I think this kind of further underscores what Valerie's talking about, which is, you know, CEOs, C-suites and companies not waiting for the crisis or waiting for attention. Because these days, something is coming. And there's two factors. Why? There's been announcements by, you know, BlackRock, Vanguard, even Goldman Sachs has said that they are not going to support IPOs for companies with non-diverse boards. I mean, so there are business parameters that are happening in terms of investment, investors, even in terms of employees. What we see now is employees in this war for talent, they want a company that's going to reflect their social values. They want a company, they want to, and when they're more talented and they're further up the ranks, it becomes more about that individual desire, less than a company need. So the one thing is there's true, you know, business parameters around it and in making it a business imperative. The other thing is every bit of research, and it's very fascinating to watch, has said that better decisions, better performance, better outcomes at all levels of the company come with diversity. Yeah, so this isn't a human capital imperative. This is not a, you know, HR issue. This is a how do I make my business better in a very, very competitive world? The research is there. Interestingly enough, S&P 500 did a survey that said that companies with diverse boards that are listed on S&P 500 actually weathered the COVID crisis and the economic downturn better than those who did not have diverse senior leadership. So the question is, okay, I've got to go out and get this. Getting to your point, how do I do it? The data is a beacon. You know, that's right. It is going to tell you, and we, you know, there's different forms of research, take it, you know, disaggregate it. It's going to tell you exactly what your priorities are. Because the first thing is you can't, there are so many tactical elements, and we're not even going to talk about tactical elements. So many things you can do. The question is, what should you do that's going to bring you the right result? And data will tell you that. You know, we look at data and say, okay, these should be your priority areas. And then, of course, you match up so many very different, you know, elements of tactics to do that. The other thing it has to be to make it work, to your question, is you got to bring in your middle managers. You got to bring in terms of not just, you know, making great messaging from the top after you've, or after the C-suite has an epiphany, but it really has to be engaging, you know, within the organization, and people have to feel empowered.
Yeah.
Not that they're going
to
have some kind of repercussions against them if in fact they don't. The last thing I'll say about that is, you know, think about how from a C-suite CEO, him, her, they, think about how much studying they have to do just to do their job. They will learn and they understand. We need to make sure that people, leaders, employees further down the chain are also given opportunities to learn and understand. Because a tell strategy and do it because I said it or because this memo came out is not the roadmap to success.
So data must inform your strategy. And if you're not looking at the data, your strategy is not metrics led. So that would be point number one. I had a call with a client this morning where we were doing a readout on data. And we took them through mounds of information. But at the end of the conversation, it was, so here's why these are the four things you need to do. It is very, very easy in this space to pick off 100 things, probably 95 of which do not give you results. I had one, and just another important example, a Fortune 100 client. When I walked into the organization, they had dozens of activities. We reached into the data to figure out what the issues were. And we came out of that analysis and said, there are 10 things you need to do. And Mr. CEO, these two belong to you. You must do these two to facilitate these next three, and then the five after that. And so when I talk about treating this like any other strategy, for leaders, you would understand where your issues were in any other challenge, but you would write, it's not about the data, it's about what the data informs about what you should do, right? Come up out of that data and figure out, is it that your recruiting process is broken and needs overhaul? Is it that your performance management process is broken and need overhaul? It might be both, but in most organizations, if you look into the information, you can see exactly where it is, and then you can set a strategy accordingly.
Let me offer this because there's something that Lisa said that picked this. I said a minute ago, Black-led organizations tend to produce more Black leaders. So let's take Melody Hobson, for example, right? So Melody, who graduated from Princeton, goes to Ariel, where John Rogers has founded Ariel, and she grows there. She becomes her own personality. She becomes leader at the company. That's what got her into board positions. That's what's got her into a chair of the board position, right? So across the country, there are leaders who are inside of Black-led organizations. If you look at MSNBC, where I spend a lot of time, probably a lot of people don't pay attention to, but when they started to hire Black hosts, MSNBC, those Black hosts started hiring and bringing on Black pundits and Black talent. Those Black talent and pundits have now moved up, and some of them are ending up with their own shows in other places, right? Because they're growing talent inside of those organizations. Now, not every Black leader is going to care to do that. But if you're starting to say, where is the talent? I would argue looking at institutions that are Black-led is the first place. And some of those institutions exist inside of white mainstream institutions, mainstream companies, but there are Black leaders in those companies who really care, who are nurturing and mentoring and getting people. That's my last data point, which is in Hollywood, they're starting to have a little bit of success on some of the metrics. But if you dig underneath and you disaggregate, what you see is it's not that Martin Scorsese necessarily is hiring more people of color in his production. It's that Ava DuVernay now is hiring people, and Shonda Rhimes is now hiring people, and F. Gary Gray, who's doing the Fast and Furious movies, is now hiring more people. And so those leaders of those productions are hiring new talent. That talent is now filtering out throughout the rest of the industry.
That's not to say you don't want to hold the other people accountable, though.
It's not.
Right.
It's not. Mm-hmm. But if you're gonna solve a problem,
you want both.
You gotta find people right now. I'm just telling you.
That's right.
First start looking, and then you can broaden your search from there.
So Lisa, I want to go back to something you were talking about earlier, because, you know, we're talking about all of the data. We're talking about leadership and whatnot. But, you know, Taneo and we are ultimately there's a communications element to what we do. And so I'd be remiss in not asking you about this, because it goes to something you were talking about bringing middle management along and bringing the new joiners along, or getting them to want to join your organization in the first place. And I think ultimately this gets to my institutionalization question of how, you know, once these, you know, again, showing the courage to be transparent about the data and recognizing the issue, and actually coming up with an actionable plan that can be implemented. But how, you know, challenging is it, and how do you counsel then CEOs and C-suites on how to socialize this through the organization and not just say, hey, listen, this is the way we're going, everybody follow or get off, but like get this ingrained in the DNA of an organization?
Yeah, there are a couple of things that we counsel on. The first one goes back to the idea of having a foundational base, because everybody knows that when companies go through change, research has consistently shown that employees, even though there might be negative outcomes, call it risks, right sizing, shutting, whatever it is, they will take it better if they understand the strategy. What's underneath this? What's the problem? What's the solution? Same here. You've got to give people the understanding. And in an issue like this, it's also speaking to people where they are. When I say speaking to people where they are, how we counsel and how we come up with, you know, messing about is we don't just have a conversation for African Americans. We don't just have a conversation for C-suiters. You know, the truth is the whole business gets better when there's diversity. And that has benefit for everyone, whether you're, you know, an unrepresented population or where you're the most represented population. Valerie had some incredible information that I would say she might share about. We sometimes talk about the issue as if it is just about repairing wrongs. You know, and then of course, what's the natural thought? Hey, I didn't do anything to that person, so why do I have to give anything? You don't. That's not what this is about. And what we have to go to, what we spend a lot of time on, is there's a whole way to message and to share such that people are brought into it and understand the benefits that they have, whether you're not represented population or you are. Everyone is supposed to have a seat at table. It's interesting. We talk about diversity, equity, inclusion, and all of a sudden people start going to exclusion. You know, how can I just talk about this but not talk about that? Well, how can I do something for this and not do something for that? No, it's about inclusiveness. It's about bringing people in, and everybody has an opportunity to benefit. So we've got to change that whole narrative, that whole discussion that's going on, you know, in this country and other places about who DE&I actually, you know, supports, helps, why. We're having the wrong conversation about that. And when we work with companies, we talk about putting it on the right plane and the right discussion and the right actions and activities that will bring about, you know, clear results and in a way that doesn't pit one versus the other.
It's not intended to be a zero-sum game, right?
Right, exactly. Right.
It's intended to be lifting all boats, and you need context. Other populations need to have context in how it helps and relates to them. I think the example you might be talking about, Lisa, is the one I gave you the other day, where I was talking to a client who was challenged in a town hall after the company publicly proclaimed that they would spend more investment in the Black community specifically. And the challenge was, well, wait, why are you spending all that money on Black talent? You're not spending it on other organizations. And I said to the leader, did you share the context that you looked at the analysis for the last 10 years and you had spent 10 times as much on those other populations and very, very little on this population? Well, I wasn't really comfortable sharing the data. It all comes back to like being open and honest with the people who you lead of what the challenges are for the organization. Again, just like you would for any other business strategy, right? There's always context that can be laid that helps others get on board with the organizational strategy.
Can I ask you something about?
Can I think it might be worth the conversation? And we also had this too, sorry. And that is, you know, why are we talking about African Americans? How does this match up with, you know, Latinx or, you know, gender diverse? You know, why is this the conversation? That's the other question that always comes up, whether it comes up verbally or not.
Yes.
It's there.
Yes.
And needs to be addressed.
Yeah.
You know, we obviously, for obvious reasons, we're talking at a very, we're talking about a lot of generalities here. But as you three counsel individual leaders and companies, things get real specific real quick. And mm-hmm. I got to imagine that there are some companies and there are some industries where this is easier conversation to have and easier to implement change than it is in others. And I want to talk a little bit about when it's more difficult. So for instance, here in New York City, you know, particularly if you're in certain industries, there's a wealth of talent from all across the board here that's available, and maybe in certain parts of California and so on and so forth. But what happens when you've got a company that's headquartered in some part of the country where, not just in the company itself, but in the broader community, there isn't much of an African-American community, and it's hard to, maybe harder to attract people to say, I want to live and raise my family in this environment? Or if it's an industry that isn't skewing younger or isn't the kind of industry that's so dynamic that all kinds of young people want to go into that business, and you're kind of dealing with a smaller pool to choose from in general. Like, how do you work through those versus, say, these highly dynamic, you know, industries that are just attractive across the board?
So again, I love your questions because I keep giving you the same answer. it's about the data, right? So what does the data say about what you might do, particularly for larger companies? Like, what might you do in one market versus another? So where does your sourcing of candidate pool strategy perhaps be stronger for the Latinx community versus the Black community? It, depending on what kind of business you're in the retail business and so on, companies that are moving toward a more remote environment, doesn't really matter. But all of that should play into, location strategy should play into your diversity and people strategy. And too often I see organizations that are doing a standalone location strategy, but it hasn't even actually factored in the people dynamics and the people strategy within an organization.
A bunch of years ago, I did a study for the Detroit Chamber of Commerce, and we were looking at recruiting people to Southeast Michigan, what was standing in the way. And one of the things that we found was that it was very difficult at this point to get people to choose to move from some place that was warm, in particular, to Detroit, Michigan, right, where it was maybe cold for 6 months, 5 or 6 months out of the year. So the tactics began, like, you had to, again, recruiting from the population that were there, like using University of Michigan, Wayne State, Michigan State, using the schools that were there as the sourcing for schools, because if those students never leave, right, if they never get to California to realize that it can be sunny all year, then they may be much happier being at home, and they have the same quality as students you can recruit from other places. So recruitment does matter. And then lastly, I was on a call with a CEO and some other leaders a couple weeks ago, and this question came up. One of the side benefits, perhaps, of the last year and a half, almost 2 years now, year and a half, of pandemic, is that location isn't as important as it used to be, right? So you need to have some location, you need to have some people in the same space at some period of time, but everybody doesn't need to be together all the time, every day. Right. So what you may find for a particular organization is if somebody doesn't want to move to, outstate Massachusetts or someplace, right, they don't want to leave North Carolina to move to Massachusetts, maybe they can stay in North Carolina some period of the month and then be in Massachusetts some other period that you define as an institution or organization. Maybe what you find is that people are grouped together. When I was in school, I did an internship at Citibank's Global Trade Finance Group, and we were based in Stamford, Connecticut. right? And so I asked the leader of the company, of the organization one day, why are we at Stanford? And he had all these reasons about why. And then he finally said, look, we all live in Connecticut. We were tired of commuting to the city, right? So they just built an office in Stanford. So I think if we're thinking about location and people, you know, those questions, maybe there are some ways people are clustered together, right? You can put people who are all clustered in one place. Maybe you can get some sort of a shared office space in that place so they don't have to move and they can be together. Companies are figuring out all kinds of solutions is my point. And I think if you're committed to having new people who are inside the company doing things that you need to get done, you just may need to be a little bit more flexible. This is the question about culture. You may need to be a little bit more flexible. There's a quote that I keep on my wall from General Eric Shinseki, you know, which is, if you don't like change, wait until you have to handle irrelevancy, right? So we all have to start thinking about our organizations and cultures are changing. How is it that we're going to manage that? Not how is it that can we stop that from occurring?
Well, yeah, one thing that I'll just add quickly, in addition to what Valerie and Jamal just said, because I'll say in addition too, and that is, people are pretty much pack animals in some kind of way. They need a pod. And I think there, when you start looking at these locations where, you know, people may tend to say, the, you know, people of color population, not that big here, not that big, but they're there, number one. Now, so the next question is, how do I make them comfortable working in this environment? Because we've seen cases and cases and stories about places where you would think no one would ever want to go, but they've gone there because they felt included. They felt they had a pod. They felt they had a way of engaging that's going to make them and their family members. Remember, we're not talking about individual employees anymore. We're talking about units. For the most part, is those decisions typically aren't made just with one person not talking to anybody else. So we also look at, as we're counseling, how we can make that desirable, what I'll call on the hierarchy, on Maslow's hierarchy of needs pyramid.
And we only have a few minutes left, so I want to get a couple last questions in here. And the first one is this, to pick up on this pod issue, one of the other reasons why people get together in a pod is to, you know, is to provide a bulwark against something else, right? And we see companies do that all the time to push back on potential tax legislation coming against them or, you know, trade issues, trade restrictions being put on them. So to what degree though, I mean, is there an element of, you know, pod behavior here on this? Like, let's get ahead of this because we're starting to see us, you know, we're starting to see pressure obviously increasing from the investment community, ESG investing and DE&I related investing and whatnot. Obviously, you know, large institutional investors are becoming quasi-regulators in that respect. But then behind them is always that looming potential of actual regulation, which of course is a blunt instrument more often than a surgical one. So is there a notion of like, you know what, guys, we've got to get ahead of this before it's somehow forced on us in a way that it won't work for our organization? Is that fear palpable?
Absolutely. I mean, I think people know that the SEC, you know, has put in a regulation about having a minimum of one woman on boards. We've seen legislation in California and Massachusetts and coming to more towns than you, where there are legislative requirements of what board and senior leadership needs to look at. The other thing I'll say is, I mean, you know, we saw in the spring, IBM had a shareholder resolution. And we've seen a number of shareholder resolutions calling for diversity, various aspects of diversity. Some is making sure that, you know, senior leadership reflects for this parity. Some of them have been that they release data, EEO-1 data that is, you know, mandated for public companies about the diversity in their workforce. So we're seeing it come in, Kevin, to your point, from, you know, regulatory bodies, from, you know, governments mandating it, to shareholders, to investors, all coming to the table with requirements of what they want to see in for-profit you know, organizations, and it's coming to, you know, for-profit, and it's also coming to large not-for-profits, and it's coming to privately held companies, because, you know, people, this is 24/7 media access. People don't want to hear companies and organizations talk about things when they're not living the walk themselves.
So,
Kevin,
I want to close. Sorry, Valerie, go ahead, and then
yeah,
the last question.
I think it's easier. I won't say it's very easy, but it's easy in today's environment for leaders to leave this call and say that it's a location challenge. It's a regulatory challenge. I think it's important to bring the conversation back to where Jamal started us, and that is keep doing the philanthropic part of your ESG strategy. But this is ultimately about changing the composition and mix of your Black leadership inside your organizations. And there's no other than the requirement for board diversity, no one's really pushing that needle. And I think the smart, proactive C-suite leader walks away going, of all the things I have going on, I'm giving money to HBCUs, I'm starting BRGs. That's great long-term strategy. But what's your immediate strategy for increasing the population beyond the 1, 2, 3, and 4% and beyond, right? I think that absolutely has to be the message.
So I need to land the plane here in just 1 minute. So I want to ask three of you sort of a final question here, because you've all been working for years on these issues. But we also know that there are moments of increased attention, and Jamal highlighted that in his very first opening comments about George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and the Black Lives Matter movement. And that brought attention. But to what degree does it bring actual momentum, and how are you feeling about, as the events themselves sort of recede into the background, and obviously as we've seen of late, we've got a whole host of challenges still facing us as a society and a nation going forward. As certain salient moments kind of recede into the background, how does that impact? And I'm asking this because, you know, we're looking at, the Fed made the decision yesterday to start tapering. We are looking at a potential for the first round of tightening in the middle of next year, which is going to be the first time in a long, long time. When markets start to turn, do you fear that we could backtrack on this? Or do you feel that the direction of travel is set, and now it's a matter of like getting everybody on the right track? Or do we really need to be on guard against actual backtracking and derailing of this process?
Yes.
So I'll give you that. If known business results and business parity is not enough for people to stay around and stay working in this issue, if the simple fact that you're going to have regulatory bodies, investors, shareholders, employees, continue, because that's not the moment we're in, that's the world we're in. Then look at number three, demographics. World demographics, it's plain and simple. It says that companies are going to, have to address these issues, no matter what, because they're there, they're coming.
I'll finish with this. It's very natural for people to move on, to people to be amped up on something that's important, and then to move on when the crisis has receded. This is why it's so important to have leadership that is diverse, because when you have people who have skin in the game, they're not really going to move on, right? They'll still be invested. They'll still be there. So I would just say good rules are incredibly important. Good rule makers are critical. And if you really want to change these organizations, having the right team of leaders and decision makers at the table is what will give this longevity and help it stick around as a problem that can be solved for organizations.
Leaders that understand that it's ultimately a business challenge won't let it go.
This is like technology. Remember back in the day when they had secretarial pools? Once technology came, it continued to evolve. And this is like technology. The coming and here wave is going to be, it's like that. So it's going to change the way we live, we work, we play, and we relate, and how we, you know, achieve our business or organizational success. It just is. Think of it like technology. It's the next wave.
Well, great. And on that note, I want to thank all of you very much and thank everybody for joining us. You know, this has been the third call in this series that we've done. We're going to continue this into next year as well, because it's such an important issue, for us as a firm as well. And I know our clients benefit from it as well. So I want to thank Lisa Davis, Jamal Simmons, and Valerie Rainford for joining me today.
Thank you.
All of you for joining us. All the best for the weekend. If you have any questions on any of this or want to take it up with any of our guests today, please don't hesitate to email us at TeneoInsights@Teneo.com.
So there you have it. I'm Kevin Kachiwara. Thank you so much for joining us for this episode of Teneo Insights. If you have any questions about any of the topics we cover, please reach out to us at TeneoInsights@Teneo.com. See you next time.